members. I'm going to call the tax committee meeting to order. We're waiting for one more person. We'll have a quorum. We'll do the minutes at that time. Members, I want to ask the pages to pass this out. Ms. Dalton just gave this to me. Representative Demmer and Representative Zellers asked a question last time related to installation taxes, and Ms. Dalton wants us to know that there's a correction to what she said, and it's in here, so we're going to pass that out.
She was wrong.
They've never been wrong.
It's another statue. It's another statue, Madam Chair. I got to put away at my desk.
Representative DeLaForest, they've never been wrong. It's just a correction to what they said. That's how we're going to diplomatically deal with these things. It's good to know that even House research isn't exactly accurate all the time. Members, we are going to adjourn at 11, so we are down to 54 minutes to hear the tax compliance report and have questions. So we're going to have 20 minutes where we're going to hear what was in the tax compliance report. Members have heard a lot about this. It was presented, I believe, in March to the Legislative Audit Commission. I know there are a few people on this committee who attended that. I did. And I know that these issues were never brought before the tax committee in any substantive way. So now is a good time for the tax committee to get up to speed on these compliance suggestions from our auditor. Members will recall that the way that this even got studied is legislators sort of take a vote as to what kind of things they would like our legislative auditor to work on. And this is one that made it to the study level. And so now we've got the report before us. Mr. Nobles is not yet in the room, who was going to introduce Ms. Janad, who's going to do the report. So we'll just go right to that. So if we can get through that and hold on questions, I think is the best way. We're going to hear from the Commissioner of Revenue and the Assistant Commissioner and the Deputy Commissioner, I think, are going to join us then for their thoughts on the report. And then we want to spend the remaining half hour on questions from the committee so we can adjourn in time to get to State of the State. So with that, members, we'll go to Ms. Janad with the Legislative Auditor's Office. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Deborah Parker Janad. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I was the project manager on this evaluation. And with me is Dan Jacobson here also, who was working on the project as well. We focused on the income tax and the sales and use tax, which in fiscal year 2005 accounted for about three-quarters of state tax revenue. And just to remind you, the use tax is just like a sales tax, but it applies to purchases from out-of-state vendors, like catalog sales or internet sales or other out-of-state vendors. First, we can state categorically that Minnesota does have a tax compliance problem. The Department of Revenue itself has done two studies to estimate the tax gap. First, they established what taxpayers are supposed to pay, and that's the amount that you see on your screen right now.
And Ms. Chanat, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you direct members to what they're working off of? Do you have this in front of you as well? I know we've got it on the screen, but as members are looking through their packets.
They should have had
okay.
This slide.
So you're following this?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chanat.
The studies also established that for both tax types, not everyone pays what they owe. For the income tax gap is about $604 million, and for the sales and use tax, about $451 million. What do we know about these tax gaps? For the income tax gap, most people file but underreport their income. Most of that comes from the self-employed, and that accounts for about $475 million in underpaid tax liabilities. Another $124 million comes from people who don't file a return at all, and they're called non-filers. Businesses and individuals who do not pay the use tax accounted for about $272 million, and businesses that don't collect and remit the sales tax accounted for about another $180 million. So in total, that tax gap is about $1 billion annually, but let me emphasize that it's neither feasible nor desirable to collect that entire amount, and I'll come back and talk about that a little bit more in my presentation. So just a quick bit, what does the Department of Revenue do to try to address tax compliance issues? They educate and assist taxpayers to help them comply voluntarily. They identify those taxpayers who may be noncompliant. They audit tax returns. They collect payments that are due to the state. And they also try to develop ways to simplify tax policy and also the tax filing system. We focus on assistance, auditing, and collection of delinquent payments. What did we conclude? First, the Department of Revenue is using sound strategies to improve tax compliance, but we had a number of recommendations to improve the implementation of those strategies. We think they can do a better job providing telephone assistance to taxpayers who call with questions. I'm not going to focus on this today, but I would urge you to read those sections of the reports that are relevant to taxpayer assistance, and again, I'll kind of come back to this topic a little bit later. We think the department can fine-tune its audit programs to improve their impact. They need better data for identifying non-compliant taxpayers, and they can do a better job of collecting payments from people who know they owe taxes but don't pay on time. I'm going to start with auditing. First, what should a good audit program accomplish? It should raise revenue, a key interest of this committee today. It should target the tax gap, those components where we know there's a compliance problem in Minnesota. And third, and I need to emphasize this very strongly, the point is to encourage long-term voluntary compliance, because that's where the major revenue gains for the state will be found. Again, you know, an audit program should still educate taxpayers about why they're being audited and what they're supposed to do, and the department should do enough audits to create a deterrent effect. So are the department's audits productive? We found that yes, they are. On average, income tax audits yielded about $6.70 per dollar spent, and for the sales and use tax, they revenue yield was about $5.40 per dollar invested. But again, these estimates do not include added revenue that may come from improved voluntary compliance in the future, and that could be a substantial amount. These averages, though, do mask some big variations among the department's audit projects, and I'll give you just a couple of examples about why we think that's true. Too many audits resulted in no change to tax due. For example, 34% of income tax face-to-face audits in fiscal year 05 did not yield any additional revenue. That's about twice the no change rate for similar audits done by the IRS. And this suggests that the department can improve how it selects returns for these face-to-face audits. Second, we found that they continued to put resources into audit projects that identified little non-compliance relative to the investment being made. And again, the issue here isn't just short-term revenue yield. The more productive audits are, the bigger the impact they'll have on future voluntary compliance. Another objective, as I mentioned before, is to target the major components of the tax gap. So we took a look at that as well. The department has made good progress targeting non-filers. They've really ramped up the number of audits that they complete each year, and additional assessments have grown from about $15 million to $28 million annually. But keep in mind, the goal is to get these taxpayers into the door in the future. So the fact that non-filer assessments are hard to collect, you know, that is an issue. But it's really important to focus on getting those non-filers filing in future years. And the jury is still out about whether the non-filer initiative has accomplished that or made gains in that area. Regarding underreported income, the department has had less success targeting this component of the tax gap, especially among the self-employed. Mm-hmm. These kinds of audits require complex techniques and experienced staff. And the department has had a hard time because of turnover in building this core cadre of experienced and tax auditors. They want to use data mining techniques, and the department has struggled a bit with getting all the kinds of information that it wanted. But I think the commissioner and deputy commissioner will be able to address some progress that's been made in this area. And finally, Minnesota really suffered from a decline in the federal audit presence.
Excuse me.
Are you taking questions now, Madam Chair, or at the end?
Well, I hope to get through the presentation first due to the state of the state, so if we could just go through it all, then we'll have more time for questions. Thank you, Representative Earhart. Ms. Janot.
Madam Chair, thank you. Also, as I said, Minnesota really suffered from a precipitous drop in the federal audit presence in the individual income tax area that started in the late 1990s. As you know, our state income tax return is highly linked with the federal return, and we do get information from the IRS on their audit activities. So as their audit presence declines, that really hurt Minnesota. And even though we as a state and the Department of Revenue was ramping up its individual income tax audit programs, that really didn't offset the number of audits that the federal government stopped doing during those same periods. Also, the department has made limited progress targeting the sales and use tax gap. They have relatively few auditors for the number of businesses that need to be audited. So their audit presence is fairly low. They do little to enforce the use tax for households, but there is a cost-effectiveness issue there. The department just doesn't feel like that those audits are cost-effective. But in general, as e-commerce grows, the use tax problem grows. And there's, you know, little that the state can do to influence buying behavior from out-of-state vendors. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. We think the department can use data better to find noncompliance. At this time, Minnesota is one of four of 39 states with an income tax that do not participate in what's called the Fed State Electronic Return Program. In this program, the IRS will essentially process the state return with the federal return so that the Minnesota return would go through the IRS edit checks before it gets sent to Minnesota. And if we were to participate in that, Minnesota would benefit from some unique data checking abilities that the IRS has that we don't have. There are a few downsides to that, but I do know that the department is seriously considering participation in that, and they can talk some more about that later, too. Second, the state is making ineffective use of W-2 wage and tax statements. The state is still getting about a million, that's about one-fourth of W-2s on paper, which makes it very difficult to use that data effectively. And in fact, we do make a recommendation to the legislature that Minnesota businesses, the employers, be required to file their W-2 wage statements electronically and in a common format to facilitate their use by the Department of Revenue. I'd like to talk just one more tax compliance issue, and that is collecting past due tax payments. There are two general types of delinquencies. First is a balance due return where the taxpayer declares that they owe taxes but essentially don't attach the check to pay. The second type of delinquency comes from an audit assessment that's not paid within 60 days. At the time we did our work, the cumulative amount of this delinquent tax debt was about $459 million. The debts are of all tax types, but about 63% of these debts are late income tax payments. That inventory has been growing, but again, that's a byproduct, a natural byproduct of a ramped up income tax audit program. So some growth is to be expected. The amount of debt has been increasing each year, as you can see in this chart, at about an average annual rate of 5% per year, but that is not keeping up with the pace of incoming delinquencies. In the report, we lay out a number of factors that are affecting efficient debt collection. First, there were too many steps in the collection process, thousands of possible handoffs and steps in collecting a tax debt. The department tended to use a one-size-fits-all approach, and we think they should do more to tailor collection activities to the type of debtor or type of debt. All in all, the department was not meeting its goal to collect most debts within a year. At the time we did our work, 60% of the debts in inventory were more than a year old. And the older a debt gets, obviously the harder it is to collect. They need better data and ability to analyze data to really dig into their collection processes and understand, you know, what type of collection activity, you know, at what time is the best way to collect certain kinds of debts. For example, the department couldn't answer questions like, you know, how long does it take us to collect a sales tax debt, or what proportion of debts get collected at a certain stage. So let me just finish with this point that I was led to ruminate on here for a few seconds. So the tax gap is not easy revenue. Let me be clear. You know, even with the best of efforts, we will not recover this entire tax debt or even a substantial portion of it in a year or 2 years or, you know, in the next 5 years. But we do think that Minnesota can make gains in addressing and reducing the tax gap. That's going to take some different actions. You know, the first is legislative action. For example, a recommendation about W-2 wage reporting. It's going to depend on the level of resources invested at the Department of Revenue for various types of tax compliance activities, not just enforcement, but also education and assistance, efforts to simplify the tax system and processing. Depends in part on the success of the Department of Revenue strategies, and we've made quite a few recommendations to help better target the resources internally at the department. But it's also going to depend on federal action. For example, compliance is best when there's third-party information reporting, and it's more likely to be a federally led effort to improve the amount of third-party information reporting, particularly if they can somehow forget self-employment income. Another issue is the streamlined sales tax project. Federal legislation is required to allow out-of-state vendors to collect sales tax or use tax on behalf of many different states, even if they don't have a physical presence there. That change at the federal level would have, you know, a significant effect on our ability to collect use tax or sales tax here in Minnesota. And again, you know, this is a long-term strategic effort. Based on the audit data we analyzed, we can expect to actually collect, that's dollars in the door, about 10% of the income tax gap, or roughly $60 million over time, because that's kind of historically what's happened as those audits have moved through the process. But the voluntary improvements in voluntary compliance would be the big winner. For example, a modest 5% reduction in the income tax gap could yield $30 million annually. So again, you know, I want to emphasize that this isn't all about enforcement of the tax laws. It's also about making sure that voluntary compliance improves, because that's really the big bang for the buck for us. Just a few other concluding thoughts. As I said, we can't quantify how much of the tax gap can be recovered, but we do think the state can make more progress. Second, the department at the time we did our work, you know, we really had no trouble putting to good use the compliance initiative funding that they had received for several years. But we do think that their strategies are sound. There's room to improve the execution. And actually, if you look at page 85 of the blue cover, the full report, there's a list of all the recommendations that we made in the report. They're scattered. The discussion is scattered throughout the chapters, but they're compiled there at the end for you to look at. And finally, last year, one of the other issues that we talked about was that the department had been devoting a lot of energy to bringing on new staff and training them and dealing with some of the staff turnover issues among our auditor team. And at that time, you know, we felt that the department, before receiving the other compliance initiative funding, really needed some time to stabilize their operations, and particularly to get a handle on the turnover issues. But again, you know, a year has passed since we did this work, so, and I have not been back over to the department since we issued this last year, and they could probably speak more to that issue. So with that, that was the quick run-through.
Thank you, Mr. Knott. I think we'll take Representative Earhart's question, but we would ask the Commissioner of Revenue and whoever he would like to address us to join us at the table now, because we'd like to get through their response to the report and then lots of times for questions. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned this just in closing again, the turnover of auditors and the turnover of personnel. What's going on with the turnover? You don't like the commissioner? They're not paid enough? Or what?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, actually the Office of the Legislative Auditors has some similar issues. The market for auditors, well-trained auditors, is pretty tough, and the Department of Revenue has been competing with the private sector. Early in, I believe, 2006, They did get some additional authority to give faster step increases so that they could help, you know, retain. The turnover rate, though, was pretty high within 3 years. But again, they can speak more to what their current experience is.
Madam Chair, this is an allied question. Are you finding the same thing throughout government, salaries not keeping up with the private market? I know in the transportation department, they're having severe problems of people leaving and going to the private sector and more. So I assume that there's something going on here with not keeping our salaries current. Are you finding that?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, our office has not done any work on statewide competitiveness of the salary system.
No,
I can't speak to that.
Madam Chair, you mentioned it in two different departments, your own and the revenue department, so that's a pretty good sampling, I would say. And that's enough for a question on that. But.
Thank you, Representative DeLaForce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had two questions for the witness. The first one, you had mentioned that obviously it's intuitive that voluntary compliance is a good thing and the best way to go. I guess a form of pseudo-compliance is a tax amnesty, and I didn't see anything in your presentation about the effectiveness of amnesties or the Department of Revenue's policy regarding amnesty. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative, we did not do any work at all on the tax amnesty program, so I can't add any insight on that issue.
Representative DeLaForce.
Perhaps the Commissioner or somebody could expand on that a little bit. I'm just wondering if that's at all effective as a strategy. It seems to me it would be. But I'll move on to my second question in the interest of time, and that is regarding those who are, targeted or fall within the purview of these tax compliance efforts. Do we have any empirical data? I mean, how many fall in the top decile? How many are C-corps, et cetera, et cetera? Who have you audited or targeted for tax compliance?
Madam Chair, Representative, we can give you a little bit of information about that. I'd need to pull it together for you, but we have a little bit. The department is going to have more. There are some tables about the types of audits in the reports that were done. There's the income tax, actually productivity of audits. It's an interesting page 25 of the report. And also on page 56, there's some information about the number of audits that were done. We do know that, for example, in the income tax, nearly half of the tax gap is for returns with federal adjusted gross income over $100,000. If that's kind of what you're thinking about, it's a good chunk of that would be considered higher income filers.
Thank you, Mr. Nott. And if Commissioner Innes could join us now, I'd appreciate that. And I'm not sure who else. But if in your comments you could address both Representative Earhart's question and Representative DeLaForest's question, and we do want to save as much time as possible for questions.
Right.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, thanks for having us here to discuss this important issue. I'm just going to provide a little bit of overview, and then Deputy Commissioner Salmoy is going to speak to the more specifics of the report and the recommendations. This is the tax gap issue has been something that the Department of Revenue has been cognizant of for many years, and they're the ones that commissioned the gap analysis. And I think as a general rule, they've been very aggressive at coming forward to legislature with compliance initiatives and other legislative action to help close that gap. We really appreciate the legislative auditor taking a look at it. It's always good to have a fresh perspective, a fresh set of eyes to look at something like this. And we have taken to heart their recommendations. And next week when the governor unveils his budget, there will be what we deem a very aggressive multi-pronged compliance strategy as part of his budget. And it'll include basically three provisions. One that is very responsive, directly responsive to some of the things legislative auditor is recommending. And one of those is electronic filing of W-2s. We want to pursue that. We want to look into that. We want your help in enacting that. There'll also be what I would deem a more generic compliance initiative that you've done in the past, where you give us additional resources to hire auditors to go after additional audits. And that has proved very effective over the years. And we've benchmarked that very well. And we basically generate about 7-to-1 return on that investment. So that's been very effective. And thirdly, we need to upgrade our systems at Department of Revenue. And to the legislative advisory point is that we often have a hard time drilling down on the data. basically diagnosing where the best, highest return on investment audits are. And we have a proposal for what is deemed the integrated tax system in order to do a better job of identifying audit areas that need to be pursued. So stay tuned. We'd be happy to come back and talk about those in more detail. But we consider that a very aggressive proposal. We're willing to look at other options as well, but that's coming out of the gate. We're going to have that kind of three-pronged strategy. Amnesty is an issue that's been discussed in the past. I know in the past, Department of Revenue has not embraced an amnesty approach. It's something I probably need to talk to the department about additionally, but I think everything should be on the table as far as compliance, and we're willing to look at everything. I know there's that tipping point. You know, where's the point of diminishing returns on some of this stuff? You know, where's the tipping point? You don't want to become such a draconian Department of Revenue that the public only has a tolerance for so much as far as the audit area. But we want to be aggressive. We're willing to listen to you, whatever recommendations you may have. But I think a good starting point is where the department's coming out next week with our recommendation. So having said all that, I will turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Salamone, who is really very well versed in this issue and was front and center when this report came out. So he was very well versed in and can answer all your questions. Maybe one before you start, even I'll respond to your question on the auditors. And that has been an ongoing problem. And fortunately, we were able to enter into a memo of understanding, which allowed us an additional discretion to accelerate steps for the auditors. And that's helped some. And that memo of understanding is coming up for renewal. So we're optimistic we're going to get a renewal on that. But that is a really important and key component, because without that, no matter how much money you give us to hire additional auditors, there isn't a market out there based on what we were paying before. There just wasn't, and it was not possible to keep them. We would train them for a year and lose them. I think if my memory serves me right now, our retention rate is about 2.5 years versus about a year prior to entering into this memo of understanding. So it's helped. But we are competing against the marketplace, and we're a good training ground for the auditors, so they get some good background. And then they go off to the private sector where they can make some real money. So anything you guys can do to assist in that area would be greatly appreciated. And it's not unique to revenue, as you said, Representative. It's statewide. At one point, there was some talk about entering into a memo of understanding that covered a lot of the agencies, but we were kind of under the gun because we had this audit compliance initiative we had to get going on, and we had to generate some revenue. And so we kind of did a standalone deal, and it's been effective, but it's an important component that needs to be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Ernest. And before we move to Mr. Salamone, I do want to officially call the meeting to order because we now have a quorum, and I'd like members to take a look at the minutes quick so we can approve those. And while you're doing that, before I take a motion on the minutes, I do want to remind members that we will hear the governor's recommendations that affect the tax area, I believe, on Wednesday. We'll have the we'll have Commissioner Ines again here going through what the governor is proposing for his budget, and we'll hear more about those initiatives. I also want to tell members that both Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to have those members who serve on the Property Tax Division Chair Marquardt's committee who do not serve on the full tax committee joining us as well as we go through property tax orientation, and then we'll have them here to hear the commissioner or the governor's budget as well. So those 2 days, we're going to have more people in the room, so that'll be good. At this time, I could take a motion to approve the minutes.
Madam Chair, I move to approve the minutes of January 16th.
Motion by Representative Marquardt. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. And to, is the title
Deputy
Commissioner Salamone. Wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may just quickly add a couple more points to the Commissioner's comments with regard to the auditor problem. It's important to note that the solution that we, I don't know if the mic is on or not, or maybe I'm just not talking loud enough. The solution was a 1-year deal, as the Commissioner mentioned, and it is expiring. It was a revenue-only agreement between revenue, the Department of Employee Relations, and the MEIC union. So it was a very surgical thing. It was meant to give us some relief. We do see an improvement, as the Commissioner said, in the first year. We don't have as much turnover in the first year, but I think it's kind of moving downstream. We're seeing problems in the second and third year. So it's important that we continue to work on that particular issue and appreciate the question. And while I'm on a question roll here. I'll address Representative DeLaforest's question on amnesty. This issue comes up regularly here. The department has consistently taken a position against amnesty for various reasons. Number one, it demotivates our auditors and our audit function. It's inconsistent with tax compliance initiatives that we've been working hard on over the years. It's a gift that gives once and not more than once, whereas compliance initiatives sort of, it's a gift that keeps on giving. So for all these reasons, we are very pro-tax compliance, however we talk about that, but very much against tax amnesty. And I don't know that I need to say any more about that. And I certainly appreciate the question, and it's a natural thing to be thinking about. It also lets off the hook the most egregious tax avoiders, which is another reason to think twice about that. Let me just quickly thank the Commission for a great report. We think it's a good report, high-quality report. It is our agenda for the future. What you may not have seen is that, as typically is the case, the auditor has given the agency a list of all of its recommendations in a matrix form and asked to fill in the blanks in terms of what we are doing, have done, and will be doing. And we have submitted that. It's very detailed. We got policies and procedures and work being done in every area that they've recommended. So we're taking it very seriously. With the time that I have left, Madam Chair, and I'm sure there'll be other questions, I'd like to quickly go back to the tax gap and remind the committee that the tax gap is not based on tax assessments. It's an academic study. It's a theoretical assessment. In a sense, we try to determine with census data what we might expect to collect based on what we know about the economy without even looking at tax returns. That's another thing that we do, of course. And so it's kind of our speculation about what's out there to be collected, but it's totally academic. It's not based on any examination of any taxpayers, as I said in an interview a few days ago, which was aired, I guess, today, that we don't even know who those people are that owe that money. So it's a management study to determine the challenge we have. And then on a year-to-year basis, as we update the study, you can see if we're reducing the gap. I can't tell you how much of that gap is collectible. I have no way of doing that. I will say that our rate of compliance is about 11%. I'm sorry, 89%. It's about 11% gap. There are only three studies in the country that have been done. The New York State did one. They are at a 14% non-compliance. The IRS recently did a study. They're at 20% non-compliance. The state of Washington has done a sales tax study. I don't think we know what their rate of non-compliance is. There's a professor who does studies for the IRS on compliance has noted that Minnesota's compliance rate is better than the national average. So we think we're doing all the right things that the auditor noted. We can do better with management data and systems, as the commissioner mentioned. So we're hoping to see a lot of progress in the next few years. With that, I think I'll maybe stop for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Salamone. And we've got Representative Demmer, Representative Broad, Representative Liebling. We'll start with Demmer. I do want to remind members, Mr. Nod's still here in the room, and so I'm not sure, you know, who you want to direct your question to, but let's start with Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Salamone, or Commissioner, maybe you guys can answer this. I was going to talk to the person from the auditor's office, but my question has to do, as we do these compliance audits, is I'm particularly interested in the area of sales tax, where we have, I think, a lot of complexity and unknowing non-compliance. Is there a difference when you're doing audits between somebody who wasn't aware or had confusion about collecting of sales tax and, of course, finding later on that they misinterpreted and underpay versus somebody who just plain doesn't have the money anymore? In other words, the reasons for non-compliance, is that taken into consideration as you're working on these things? And do you have any information about how much is willful non-compliance and how much is determined to be they just didn't know?
Madam Chair, Representative, we do take into account the circumstances, and I think every audit is an educational opportunity. And unless we have obvious information that indicates intent to not comply, I think the audit takes a different tone. It takes much more of an instructional tone. Here's what: how can we help you get this right in the future? The sales tax is actually one of the most complicated taxes we have. Most taxpayers, citizens who are intimate with it, would not understand that. But there's a lot of fine distinctions that have to be made because the laws aren't always very clear in terms of how you distinguish things, products or services. And so we have to make that judgment call. And taxpayers are often confused. As you know, in recent years, we've had a lot of complexity in the drugstore in terms of what's taxable and what isn't. We've had several sales tax commissions to try to sort all that out. We're making a lot of progress. With regard to the sales tax, the biggest area of noncompliance, it's about 60 to 70% of that gap, is use tax compliance, where we have issues with remote sales from retailers who have no nexus in Minnesota, and we're not able to enforce a collection responsibility. We will make some progress with that. We've made a lot of progress in recent years. I think we're at the point where we need federal legislation to really hit the home run and get the revenue in that we hope to get someday. So it is a very troublesome tax right now.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Broad, Liebling, Earhart, Solberg. Representative Solberg, was that to this point? No. Okay, Representative Broad.
Oh, Madam Chair, he asked my question.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Salamone. I have a couple of questions. One of them Representative Demmer kind of touched on, but I wanted to go a little bit more into that, and that is when we talk about voluntary compliance and improving voluntary compliance, partly through doing audits and so on, is there any, have any studies been done about, you know, what are the components of voluntary compliance? In other words, you know, we have the stick, but we also have the carrot, and I know, I think you just addressed part of it, and I think what I heard you saying is that complexity has something to do with it. But are there other things that we might know from the academic literature or anywhere else that might help us kind of figure out how we can improve things on the voluntary compliance side? And then I have a follow-up question as well.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think the short answer is that it's a function of simplicity of the tax laws. And by the way, you guys did a great job recently with the Federal Conformity Bill, and that means a lot. And it would have complicated the return and caused a lot of difficulties, potentially, for compliance. Education is a big part of that. Our job is to, first of all, we have the laws, then we do the forms. They have to be clear, easy to understand. The instructions have to be clear. And then we have to be out in the field educating taxpayers about what their responsibilities are, trying to figure out where the confusion areas are so that we can bring more materials to that. Our website is going to be very helpful, has been very helpful in that area. So there's just a whole array of things that we do short of auditing and finding problems with the returns that help us get that 89% voluntary compliance. We ought to be trying to get that higher with more education, and that's a big thrust, a theme in the auditor's report, that we need to have more educational programs, particularly now in areas with the growth in the non-English speaking populations and cultures that have no context for taxation. We have to reach out to those groups and get them to understand their responsibilities. So it is quite complex, but there is a long list, and I could elaborate perhaps in an email or some way with further information if you need it.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess from what, part of what I draw from that is that when we think about passing some new piece of legislation, we should think about whether we're making things more complicated and then perhaps making it more difficult for people to comply. But the second thing I wanted to ask about relates to this too, and that is that I had a bill in 2005 to institute, to have your department have a toll-free number for help, taxpayer assistance for people from out of state. And that bill didn't go anywhere, and I'm wondering, what's the status of that? Do you have a toll-free number now for people from outstate? And if you don't, wouldn't that be something that would be kind of a no-brainer that would help people comply as well? And even if it doesn't, it's kind of a customer relation issue?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I understand we don't have a toll-free number anymore. I think we got rid of it because of cost issues. And we are promoting other methods of allowing people to get in touch with us. It's something we should be looking at, perhaps, to reassess, but I think the original assessment was that it was not cost-effective in terms of the numbers of people who were using it.
Thank you. I sense another bill. Did you want to say something on this point? Commissioner Ines, then we'll do...
I want to speak a little bit to that, Representative Liebling's previous point about taxpayer education and involuntary noncompliance, which I think is a larger issue, is a very large issue. One of the issues is use tax. I mean, how many people walking down the street actually know that a use tax is owed on out-of-state purchase over the internet? And how to get the information out to the taxpayers about what exactly their responsibility is an ongoing challenge. I know a number of years ago there was a proposal, I think it was Senator Kierlin. He thought about putting a use tax line on the income tax return as a way of flagging that issue for people and saying, you know, if you If you've made a purchase out of state or on the internet, you know you have to pay the differential between the sales tax to pay in that jurisdiction and here in Minnesota. And, you know, it's just a way to try to flag that issue to folks. I think most people on the street, they're shocked when you tell them you have to pay a sales tax on an out-of-state purchase. And so we're always revisiting that, and if you have any good suggestions on how we can flag that, those kind of issues, to get taxpayers on notice. You know, a few years ago, too, we passed that de minimis exception. And so there's that de minimis exception out on the use tax, but the bigger question is how to go after that growing and growing piece of noncompliance. I think it's involuntary noncompliance for a large part on internet sales and the like. And, you know, under Dan's watch, the agency has been exceedingly aggressive on streamline. We've been at the table. And I think that's kind of the global solution, I think, ultimately, is have a streamlined sales tax initiative succeed at the federal level. But and the department has been fairly aggressive at being, you know, strong advocates for the streamlined sales tax.
Thank you. We'll do Earhart, Solberg, Tao. I do want to tell members further thoughts on the use tax that the commissioner was just talking about. Ms. Dalton is of great help to members in understanding how it used to be, what's happened since de minimis, how we track these things, and it is complicated. And if members want to delve into that a little further, Ms. Dalton is a wealth of information. But in the interest of more questions, we'll go to Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the supposed offshore lack of collection or compliance or whatever it is, that gap, do you get into that at all, or are you suggesting anything that should be done?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, we've only done two gap studies, one in the individual income tax and the other for the sales tax. So we have not done a business tax or a corporate tax gap study. And I think doing those would be extremely difficult given the complexity of...
Well, Madam Chair, Commissioner, where does all the noise come from about the billions of dollars that we're not collecting, or the hundreds of millions, I guess, would be more appropriate, in state taxes, because we've got corporations that are illegally or otherwise skirting our tax laws, and we want to close that gap, and then we have enough money to upspend everything that we're spending for in state government. And I hear that constantly.
Representative Earhart, this is a very good point. A very good point, and I think committee members should listen to this answer, because often people feel that we're talking about businesses who are doing something illegal, and they're actually not. They're following the law. So the rhetoric around this issue is complicated. The discussion is really around, should we change the law? But, Commissioner, if you could go into this a little bit, because I do think Representative Earhart has raised a point that not only do legislators misunderstand, but Minnesotans misunderstand. So if we could get a little clear understanding on the FOC issues as it relates to compliance, they're interchanged a lot, and they're really quite different things. So, Commissioner Innes.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. And I know when this tax analysis came out, and legislative body report came out, I think there was a lot of confusion about what was in the universe of noncompliance, and people thought the FOC issue was part of the noncompliance issue. And to your point, Madam Chair, that's not a noncompliance issue. They are compliant with the laws as they are drafted. There may be a philosophical debate that we need to have about the appropriate role of the FOC, but the FOC, I mean, they're using within legal parameters that the legislature and judicial system has marked out. So that's a separate debate. It's one worth having. I'm sure it's one we will have. But it's distinct and separate from this noncompliance issue. I don't know if I can add much.
And Representative Earhart, I am certain that those foreign operating corporations pay their auditors a lot more than the state of Minnesota pays their auditors. So I think it is within the legal parameters, but it's also difficult in some of these multinational corporations to understand in any great detail what's going on in the tax system. So we really are at a disadvantage, and Minnesotans should know that when we pay an auditor a certain level salary and we're competing with the head tax person for a multinational corporation and trying to get through that, you know, two-inch document when they file their taxes. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, part of my answer question has been asked already by Representative Liebing, and that's the 800 number. I noticed in the list of recommendations on page 85 of the report that it talks about access to telephone assistance. during a period of high demand for the department. Now, I know you cut that out as a budget-saving device, but sometimes if we're going to have the process of voluntary compliance, we want to make the question of, if I have somebody in Grand Rapids ask the question, and I can ask the question and get a long-distance call and wait for a long time to get the answer, or have some kind of a 800 number that I can call. And if you look at the other recommendations that are underneath that, it's improving how those calls are routed as well. So I think that you need to strongly look at that, particularly in a timely fashion, because people will be asking and doing that compliance quickly and be asking those questions. It was something that was put in. I remember when we put the 800 number in, I remember we took it out, and it may not be cost effective, but it also helps the average person do the voluntary compliance that we need to have in the system. And I want you to take strong recommendations or look at those other recommendations on not only the 800 number, but how you route those numbers within the department.
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Silver, on your point, and to the question that Representative Liebling had asked, I understand that the toll-free number is a 9 cents per minute call, whereas a normal toll call would be about 3 to 5 cents per minute. So it's actually better off for taxpayers not to use at least the 800 number we had. And maybe we need to educate taxpayers a little bit about that. But I certainly take no issue with the points that you're making. In terms of the peak call period, the lion's share of those calls, 75% or more, are where's my refund? Even though we do refunds in 1 to 3 days, 2 to 3 days, we get 75% of our calls saying where's my refund. They can find that information on the web. They can also go through our automated telephone line system and get the answer to that question as well. So we have some educating there to do as well.
Representative Silver.
Not everybody has the web available.
I understand. That is a challenge.
Or knows how to use it, including me. Manager, I do have one other question, if you could please. I think last year, two years ago, we counted that $91 million of additional money being brought in. I think that was the number. And I understand you're on path to meet that goal.
Correct. I think at this point we've collected about 82% total, and with 6 months to go, I think our best projection is we'll exceed $100 million.
Okay, Madam Chair, then my question is, I can't remember how much we appropriated for you to do that.
17.8
or something like that.
17 million?
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tao.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, either the commissioner or deputy commissioner could try to answer this. I know that the department's job is to go after people who don't file and don't pay. And are there any programs, or are you looking at people who overpay? I ask this question because I know of two instances where someone did overpay and they didn't get the money back until they switched and got a new auditor or someone else to refile for them, to redo all the paperwork. And so are there situations that the department have done in this cases?
That's a great question.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Deputy Commissioner.
Representative Tao, our mission statement is very simple. It says everyone pays the right amount, no more, no less. And so we have, as an operating rule, when the taxpayer is overpaid, we return the excess. So we don't penalize taxpayers for being ignorant of the law and accidentally paying more than they owe. I think that's the only way to go. It's a fair way to go. And we are also out in the field educating. We have a lot of allies who help us, the CPAs and various other interest groups that are working with populations that we are trying to reach to make sure people understand their obligations and how to fill out those tax forms. But the short answer to your question is yes, we do provide refunds when there are overpayments.
Representative
Tom. The follow-up question is, do you actually audit and see if people have overpaid and voluntarily refund them back?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I think that just falls out of our audit program. When we're auditing, it will be evident that they've either overpaid or underpaid, and then we take the appropriate action. We don't have a program that says we're going to expend a lot of energy trying to find overpayers. I don't know that you'd want us to do that. Sort of a reverse tax initiative. That's the fly for this.
Oh, there might be a member or two here who would.
Okay.
Not in the room at this point.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Either Commissioner. First of all, isn't there some kind of a cross notification between the IRS and Minnesota Department of Revenue with regard to taxes owed or due, or one of them comes across something? And then, if that's true, the second question is, there was a question earlier, why don't we do the tax forgiveness? If Minnesota did a tax forgiveness, wouldn't Minnesota under that agreement have to notify the IRS, who would come after them with penalties?
Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, we couldn't control what the IRS does with a taxpayer. If we had an amnesty program, I assume we only have statutory authority to forgive the Minnesota tax, not the federal tax. So they would do
this. Minnesota legislature may take over.
There might be an issue there. But we do exchange a lot of information with the IRS. We get audit reports from them. We have a lot of memos of understanding. We work as close together as we can. Often there are systems issues, and we hope to get those resolved in the future. We interact with the Federation of Tax Administrators and the Multi-State Tax Commission and a number of other tax organizations that focus on trying to build more bridges and share more data with the IRS. So we're on that, and there's a lot of things that we're currently doing.
Well, some more.
Madam Chair, just a follow-up. Well, then wouldn't we probably turn that information over that there was non-payment to the feds, and they would
we do
a good chance they would then go after them with penalties? Okay.
Thank you. And we'll take a couple of closing comments here from Commissioner Innes. We're going to adjourn to get to State of the State, but Commissioner Innes, I know we're going to get a lot more detail next week. Any closing thoughts for committee members before we adjourn?
No, I really appreciate you giving the opportunity to present this to the committee. Look forward to next week and unveiling kind of specifics of our compliance initiative. We want to be as aggressive as we can be on this. So any other ideas that you guys may have on how to close that gap, we'd be very appreciative of. I think we've got to bear in mind, though, there's not $1 billion out there that's easy to mine, easy to get at. It's going to require a lot of effort. It's going to require your help. It's going to require internal change at the agency. But I think we can make some progress on that. And we're
members,
working with you.
Thank you. One last item. I do want members to know that Commissioner, Legislative Auditor Nobles is in the room, if he can wave his hand. He was doing another presentation. I want to thank Ms. Janot for her excellent presentation, and we are adjourned.